Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 480 featuring Chad Wanstreet, who is a VFX supervisor, and he has been supervising many great episodic work. He's been doing this mostly on the studio side these days, which is also very fascinating to sort of hear the difference of working for a VFX house or working on a studio side. He's worked on many, many great shows, including Sympathizer, SWAT, The Tick, and much, much more. So really interesting to hear about that. I really love this episode because Chad and I almost crossed paths many, many times, it seems like, including his early career over at working at SpeedShape and his connection there in Detroit. I worked at SpeedShape, not exactly at the same time, but very close, and sort of how his career sort of evolved from there. So really cool to see that. He worked at Blur, a bunch of other really great places. So really nice to talk to Chad. And I have a feeling that if he and I worked together, we probably would have gotten along very, very well. We still do get along. We got along really well on this podcast. Okay, I got a couple of product announcements I want to let you guys know about. This is available at chaos.com. First is our virtual production tool called Project Arena. If you have an LED stage or you have access to an LED stage and you want to know more about Project Arena and how you to get that working, you can go to chaos.com/virtualproduction and sign up there. If you're interested in Vantage, which is the main tool that is behind Project Arena in terms of real-time ray tracing, there is a big announcement about that too. Virtual Production 2 Update 5 is out. It seems like we just announced Update 4, but Update 5 is already out, and there's several features that have been added to that, including VR support through OpenXR. Yes, you can put a VR headset inside of Vantage. Yay, super excited. We also have added animated vegetations that are happening directly inside of Vantage, also a fascinating addition. And we've added some support in certain shaders, such as rounded corners. And ACCG support. So really, really cool. We also like to talk about Corona 12 that's been added. And Super Corona, obviously, was a great, great renderer that we're also very, very proud of. And it has added support for exporting to Vantage. So yes, if you are in Corona and you want to be able to see your stuff in Vantage, you now have that ability. I guess in a way, you probably can go from Corona to Project Arena as well. I don't know if that actually works yet, but it probably will very soon. So super excited about that. Other big things that have been added to Corona 12 is scattered instant brushes, curved decals, virtual frame buffer too. So lots of new improvements there, including Corona EXR or CXR files that allow you going straight to editing in your Corona image editor. So lots of stuff again in Corona 12, and make sure and check it out. Just go to chaos.com for that information. And speaking of which, if you want to know more about this in terms of events, just go to chaos.com/events. The event I want to talk to you about is on July 9th, which I believe is the day after this podcast comes out, or maybe the day this podcast comes out. There is going to be a free webinar on Corona 12 and Vantage. So if you guys want to know more about that, just go to chaos.com/events. Before I go into the podcast, I'd like to read an acknowledgement. Chad, as I mentioned, was on the podcast and super excited to do that. But after we recorded this podcast, he sent me some news and he asked me if I could read an acknowledgement for him, which I'd be happy to do. So here you go. Chad and the entire Sympathizer team are saddened by the passing of our friend and colleague, Dan Lombardo. Dan was an exceptional friend and a bright beacon on the visual effects team for the show. His loving disposition and kind heart always made even the hardest days enjoyable, and his dedication to the team was infectious. Dan's hilarious stories about the many years in the visual effects industry will be missed, and we will all proudly cherish working with him. So thanks so much for sharing that with us, and we're very sorry for everyone's loss. Please enjoy episode number 480.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, You need to make sure everything has Fernell.
All right, Chad, thank you so much, man. It's been awesome to be able to connect with you, and I'm excited to hear about your background and know more about what's happening in your life. Obviously, the world of visual effects right now is changing quite a bit, and there's a lot of changes, exciting changes, different changes, and I'd like to sort of hear your thoughts on all that. But let's start with your background. Where did you get into CG? Like, how did you get interested in computer graphics?
So, architecture.
Oh, same as me. Nice.
Yeah. So you and I have been like circling the same group of people for a long time. Like Lyndon Bennard is a very close friend of mine, right?
Nice. So
he and I grew up together.
In Michigan.
Actually, okay. Yeah. Oh yeah, right across the street from each other.
Wow, there you go.
We got in a lot of trouble together. But if I were to say how I got into CG, it would be Lyndon first, and then architecture. Lyndon was my like secret weapon in architecture school, and how I started using like V-Ray and everything, because like he was on V-Ray free or whatever. Sure. At the time at SpeedShape, and I was in architecture school like doing all of these like visualizations and all this stuff, and then I also started freelancing and, you know, early days of ArcViz.
Where were you going to were you going to architecture school in Michigan as well, or?
So no, I went to school for music, percussion performance in Michigan, and then in Ithaca as well, for graduate studies. And then I wound up at a small school in New Hampshire called Keene State, where I started architecture, and then went to UMass Amherst for graduate studies. I only did 1 year there, and then like I just got busy and started doing other stuff. So
did you ever practice architecture?
No, because everybody, like, I was doing all these fancy renderings and everything, and everybody was, like, super excited to have me participate on that. And it was way more fun because I was in, the design stage of everything, and all my friends were, like, draft monkeys, and I was doing all this
fun stuff.
I was like, well, this is way better.
I know exactly where you are, because I was doing the same thing. I remember at one point, people, like, I had my internship over at a company called Fox and Fowl, and all the other interns were like cutting.
I know Fox and Fowl, of course.
Yeah, and they were cutting foam core and stuff, and I was creating these massive animations, and they're like, how is he having all the fun? It's like, well, I learned this stuff.
Yeah. So oddly enough, one of my good friends was like one of the partners there at Fox and Fowl for many years. And one of those people that was teaching me, Donna Paley.
Oh my God. Okay.
Donna Paley.
Yeah.
So, she was there for a while and then wound up, in New Hampshire. Yeah. And so
I was there that summer is when they were building like their biggest project today, which was at a number 4 Times Square building, that giant building with a big curved, that's what they're building there. And I was working on a small building called the American Bible Society. And we had the same foam core model. And it was funny because we realized that our entire building could fit inside the lobby at the same scale of the other building.
Nice.
So, that's cool. Sorry, I digress. It was a little reminiscing. Okay, so you were doing visual effects back in those days, or doing ArcViz, I guess. Yeah.
ArcViz. And then we had our first kid, and it was 2008. So, like, the economy tanked, and architecture, you know, was in the dumps when the economy tanks. So Lyndon and I were talking, and he was like, come work at SpeedShape. It'll be great. We're expanding. Everything's great at SpeedShape. So I went to work at SpeedShape.
Nice. Okay, so that I guess that 2008, that was a little bit after I left, right? I left there. Right.
It was. You would left, I think, like a month or two prior to me arriving. It was definitely like Chris is gone. No.
Okay. But were you doing automobile stuff, I guess, at that point? Yeah.
Yeah, so when I started, it was like still like the GM configurator days, and they lost that contract in like the first month or two that I was there.
Okay.
And then they like laid off a bunch of people. And, you know, Lyndon, when we had talked originally, and this is, you know, if I'm giving away too much, I don't think so, but it was like, we're going to expand to Boston. And I wanted to go back to Boston. So it was like, oh, well, sweet. Like, yeah, I want to go back. So we start, and they laid off like 30 people, and I go in. I'm like, dude, what's happening? It's like, oh, no, they're just trimming the fat. They're trimming the fat. And like, Sure. So another 3 months goes by, another 30 people get laid off. And then my wife goes in for labor. And while I'm gone, Lyndon's like, dude, when can you get back? Like, if you, you know, they're going to lay off more. Like, I'm gone. Like, I'm You're having right. a kid. So I came back, still had my job, and there were 10 of us left wow. at that point.
Daily office, like, I guess, at this point was closed, right?
Well, it was. So we were still occupying that same. Yeah, the LA office was still okay. open. But it was just like barely humming right. along, you know.
Was the
like,
Blackbird project Marco done at this there. Point?
Blackbird okay. was done at, by yeah. this point. Yeah. 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 Like Blackbird.
Just to give
finished,
people perspective,
in, like,
Blackbird people
days.
In this process. Blackbird project yes. was this spec project that was run under Rob Niederhorst. And Rob Niederhorst mm-hmm. was part of SpeedShape at that time. And so it was this big. Big project that was actually kind of a big deal because the director of Blackbird was actually who else? Joe Kaczynski. And it was Joe had sort of not done needed to get into doing big car commercials. And that was his first one yeah. that he had done under his relationship with Rob Niederhorst. Got that. And because of the Blackbird project, he got a bunch of other car commercials that he did over a digital domain. And because of those commercials mm-hmm. at digital domain, that landed
Gears
him
of War.
Tron.
Well, first Gears of
Gears
War.
Of War, that's true. Yes.
Yeah. Because that was like one of the most epic video game trailers
for sure
ever,
for sure
right
but like, Blackbird was the one that sort of
yeah,
got
totally.
His feet off the ground
kicked it
yeah
and it was beautiful
oh it's
like,
gorgeous
it was so gorgeous.
There's no question of
Joe started, like,
yeah no
out.
No question of Joe's capability of commercial. He actually did a really mm-hmm. beautiful commercial that no one saw before that over at Sway, which was a clove mm-hmm. cigarette commercial for Indonesia. It was gorgeous.
Huh. I have yeah. no doubt.
I don't think most people know that or have ever seen it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so
no,
okay, so you're still part
amazing.
Of this thing. This company is kind of like, you don't know where it's going. You're a new
yeah.
father. You're probably a little worried about your benefits, right?
It was definitely stressful. And when, so we went down to like the 10 mm-hmm. people, you know, like Jared, Mike Ward, Roger Pruden, mm-hmm. Lyndon, and Dave Gray,
yep.
right? And we just started doing tons of work. That's when they started doing like animations and all these
yeah,
other
diversifying.
Things.
Yep.
So it was like, yeah, and we were diversifying big time. It was no longer configurators
sure.
and, you know, because that work was largely gone. It was like Ford. We were doing those Mustang commercials and some things here and there for Camaros mm-hmm. and whatever. So we got into more like true visual effects as opposed to just like technical art
sure.
pieces, you know, for automotive and doing more like simulations and fume effects and Houdini and all of that stuff. So in doing that, I wound up doing a brief stint at RTT.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Right. As all people in Michigan, mm-hmm. I think, do. And then Pluto. Do you know those guys? Dave Corbett and Tim. Shoot. I can't remember. I can't believe I'm forgetting
That's
Tim's
right.
last name. Anyway. They were a little studio. They were like a little post place doing a lot of motion graphics and stuff. And they got it in their mind that they wanted to diversify into mm-hmm. CG. So James Vicor, myself, and John Akira went over and started a little thing. And Lyndon would freelance with us, all this stuff. But we were doing a bunch of like commercials and car configurators and little kind of specky
sure.
stuff. But at that point, I got in contact, or Blur got in contact
oh.
with me while I was working there, and that's how I wound up coming out to LA.
It's through Blur.
They hit me up about a job.
Okay.
And I wound
so,
up
okay.
here.
So okay, so Blur, how did so how? Because I know I've actually have a story about applying to Blur and how to get. It's hard to get a job at Blur, right? You almost
yeah.
It's almost like Tim has to personally find you and like say this guy's person good, you know.
It was interesting because I didn't apply. Like, I never reached
yep,
out to
they
them.
They actually
and
find you sometimes, right?
Uh-huh. Well, a friend of mine had applied.
Okay.
Daryl Johnson. Mm-hmm. I think you know him, right? So he had applied, and I wrote a recommendation for him. And then, what's her name? Monica. hit, like, just responded, like, that was a really nice recommendation. You know, thanks so much. You were, you know, very quick to do it. I'm like, okay, cool. Like a month later, I get an email from Monica. Hey, by the way, we looked at your stuff. Do you want a job? Like, what?
Amazing. Yeah.
And it's like, could you cut a more recent reel? I'm like, yeah, I guess. Sure. So I cut another reel, and then they're like, yes, we're definitely interested. And then they flew me out. I met Tim, met with Monica, met with Keith, you know, all those guys. And that was that's that. And then I was selling my house in Michigan and on a plane like a couple
months
later.
So what year was that about?
That was 2014. Okay. So I started on Groundhog, which was Halo. Well, actually, I started on Batman, Arkham Knight, at my house in Michigan.
Right.
Working in my basement from like 1 o'clock in the morning till 8
was Kevin Margo working on that? Was he the soup on? Yeah.
Yeah, Margo was on that. Yeah. So he was my supervisor. Supervisor on that. And then I wound up on Spider-Man again while I was in Michigan. Because like in the interim before I moved out, they like started just like throwing me all this random work. So I was working on the Spider-Man movie and then doing like assets and stuff like that on Batman. But yeah, Margo and then David Stinnett was on the Spider-Man movie. Right. And so when I came out, I was still finishing up the Spider-Man movie and I was doing everything in Nuke. And as we know, they were a fusion studio.
One of the last ones.
So,
I mean, and I'm sure they had, this must be a problem. Up. Like, cause no one knows fusion except for Blur people at that point. Right.
Yeah. Pretty much. Yeah. It comes in really handy nowadays when Resolve, where you're like, oh yeah, I can string all this together. But I wound up coming out and I remember Keith shipped my desktop out like directly to Blur from our house. And we moved here, we got here and we were still moving in and I was starting at Blur. My wife's at home and we had twin six-month-olds at that point. I have four kids, so those were the last two. So my poor wife is at home. Keith was sending her flowers like daily, like apologizing. And my first day there, I think was like a 16-hour day or something like that. Day one, right? Like true Blur fashion.
Yep.
So, and that was setting up like getting Nuke running with Jeff, who was their like head of IT and everything, or not IT, but software and everything.
And were you coming in as a generalist or as a compositor or was
it was like scene assembly generalist with the you know with the thoughts of CG supervision and other things you know how
the one company that sort of operates outside of the norm it's Blur like all their titles are different and they've always been like that from day one
so it was a very weird like mixed bag of things so I wound up doing like scene assembly and effects and a bunch of random stuff there in my time there. We did a tree, this big thing in Oprah's new office at one point. There was a whole bunch of crazy things. But
yeah.
So yeah, I worked there for almost two years. And then had a stint at Encore. And then went to Fuse FX and went for their
How long were you at Fuse FX?
3.5 years, I want to say. Just over three years.
And this was over in Sherman Oaks area, kind of?
Yeah, yeah. Well, first we were in the little Burbank office, right? And it was funny, too, because I remember Dave Altano at the time interviewed me, and Matt Von Brock, who was also there, had interviewed me, and Altano interviews me, and he's walking me around, and he's like, you know, our place isn't anything, like, glamorous or whatever. I was like, dude, I appreciate that. Like, I've worked at the glamorous places. Right. And, you know, the priorities are clear. You obviously have different priorities here. And I appreciate
that. When you see
that.
The money going into the furniture, you get a little worried, you know?
Yes. Yes, exactly. That comment can be made in other places.
Yep.
So, but then we moved to the very nice fancy place.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I'm not going to name the studio, but I was at a studio meeting at one point and we were working with a director who was very insightful. Let's just put it this way, right? And we had a meeting and I go into the conference room and like there was all new furniture in the conference room and he looks at me and goes, is this new furniture? And I said, oh yeah, it is. It's nice. And he goes, didn't you guys just have some layoffs not long ago? Why are you buying new furniture? And it's like, wow.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
When they notice that, it's like, no, I can sit in the shitty chair if you keep your artists, you know?
Yeah. Well, the funny thing, too, is everybody notices it. You get a lot of comments from clients. That's the one thing I've
always noticed. Where are your dollars going to, like, right?
They look at the tile floor, the Italian marble, like all these things, like lots of comments on.
And it's
like,
not a good thing to look like you spend money on the wrong places. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Because they know how low your profit margins are.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so actually, in that Burbank, I might have visited you guys in that little studio at some point. Like, I might have been there, with Vlado.
Yeah, we were like split in like three different spaces.
It almost looked like little houses, right? It was like all,
Yeah, there was the overheating ice cream shop. There was then the above the house or whatever, like, thing. Yeah, it was all over the place.
But then you guys got a nice, proper studio spot in Sherman Oaks, which was great.
Yeah, that was a great building. It was good for a lot, like just the expansion of everything. I mean, obviously they were at that point blowing up, you know. We just had like so much work.
And you were, Mitch was there, I think, right? Yeah,
of course. Yeah, Mitch Gates, and I mean, so many
people. Yeah. Okay. Awesome. I can't believe we haven't really connected since, and we know all this.
No, it's wild too, because, you know, like, Art is a good friend of mine,
or Art Cyan.
Nadell is a good friend of mine. Like, Nadell is like my best friend, right? So like,
nice.
So it's always like, Chris, but like, we've never
And Nadell, I was at Fuse. And I was on the list. Remember back in the old days when you had to be on the wait list for a Model 3 Tesla, right? And I had been on the list for like a couple of years, and everyone who had one was on the list. And Nadell got his before anyone, like very early. And he's like, all right, you want to? I was like, I've never actually sat in one. And so I was sat in his. We drove it around for a while in the Fuse parking lot.
Yes.
It's kind of funny. Awesome. Okay. Well, this is cool. So what were some of the big projects you were working on back then? Like you mentioned the stuff at Blur, but what were the stuff you're doing at Fuse and at Encore and stuff?
So Fuse, I wound up on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. for a little bit. I did a year. I think like everybody has to. I was a CG supervisor. I came in as a CG soup there, and did Ghost Rider.
Oh, okay. Season,
right. So, and like I do a lot of fire. That's one of like the things I really enjoy. So we did that, and then I wound up starting to like VFX soup some other shows, and I got The Tick was the my first show, like big show out, and it wound up, it wasn't supposed to be what it became, which was this just like monster of a show, and it just grew. So we did season one of that with Ben Edlund, who was amazing. And I wound up working with Nick Bradley on that, who is the post supervisor on SWAT that I work on, and Night Agent, and all sorts of stuff. Timeless, that I eventually wound up working on with Stephen Fleet. So I met him working on season one, and then he went off and had to do, I forget what he was working on at the time, but he had a bunch of stuff he was working on, so he couldn't do Tick season two. And Cindy Kerber came in and was working on Tick season two before she took the job at Sony. So I'd worked with both of them in these, like, you know, this VFX supervisor position, and there was no client side VFX supervisor. So I kind of filled that gap for them while I was working at Fuse. And Cindy would always tell me, like, you know, you need to come client side. You need to come and work for us, work for the dark side. I'm like, yeah, sure. Like, I need a job. I need a show to do that.
What is that like? And first of all, why did they say work for the dark side? Like, why is it the dark side?
She's just
joking. Understand, but there is an implication, though, right? So,
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's the smaller rebellion,
right?
Like, which isn't the dark side necessarily. But like the client, you know, you're the bad guy. So I think that's really, you know, the dark side per se.
Sure.
But so I met her and I'd worked on Timeless with Nick and some other stuff. And I wound up going to Zoic shortly after Fuse FX sold to, let me say this right, Eagle Tree.
Yep.
Sorry. So they did their whole VC thing. I wound up leaving. And when I started at Zoic, I told them, like, hey, like, I want to go client side. I'll probably end up going, you know, with Nick Bradley or Cindy Kerber or something. But, you know, that's down the road. I wound up in New Zealand on Sweet Tooth, working on the pilot for that. And I get a text message from Cindy Kerber. And she says, you know, Chad, why the fuck aren't you working for me? This is a text message. And I'm like, I just respond, are you offering me a job?
Right. Just because you never like, offered one.
Right. Yeah. And she's like, where are you in the world? And I'm like, I'm in New Zealand right now. It's like, when are you back? I'm like, you know, in like 3 weeks or something. So she's like, well, I want to talk with you when you're back. So fast forward, they wound up hiring me on SWAT to replace Victor Scalise, who had left to work on Away over at Netflix and has done, you know, One Piece. He's the supervisor on One Piece. And Jason Sperling had been on the show previously. So it was like Jason, then Victor, then me. And I've been on it since season three. So I started working on that with Nick and Cindy, who now works as an overlord. And that's kind of how I transitioned into this client side.
What is the difference? Like, how would you say the difference is from being a supervisor at Zoic to being a supervisor at, you know, at the studio side?
I mean, obviously, it's a lot more focused, right? Like, when you're a supervisor at a facility, they might have you on 5 different jobs, and you're splitting all over the place and doing all these crazy things. You're not actually, like, truly wearing the supervisor hat. It's like, you've got the facility and facility management and personnel. Like, once you move into the production side supervisor role, you have your team, and our teams are much smaller, so like interpersonal drama is not a thing that you really have to deal with on a daily basis anymore. There might be, of your 5 or however many people you've got working with you on any given day, a little issue, but it's not the majority.
But you're not dealing with
your time
pipeline
anymore.
And how big your storage space is.
Yeah, exactly. Just all of that stuff, all of your render woes, all of that stuff goes away. And it's just way more hyper-focused on what's the story, the directors, their needs, the production's needs. You know, all of these things become your day-to-day as opposed to all of those other things that you actually don't want to have as your day-to-day.
Yeah, it depends. I mean, some people like working on facility. Some people like the that low, but I get what you're saying,
Yeah, I mean, yeah, truly, I think a lot of people really enjoy it. And there's the diversity of work, which is great. Like, you get to, you jump from this project to that project to that project, and there's always something, you know, different. I think the one nice thing about the team that I've wound up with is they've put me in rooms with all sorts of other people that wasn't really anticipated when I started on SWAT, right? Like, Paul, who's one of the UPM or was the UPM, and Jim, they started coming to me with scripts in season 4. Like, Chad, look at this, look at this, look at this. And I started doing all these breakdowns for like Village Roadshow and stuff. And one of them hits me, and it's called Kill the Orange Face Bear. And I read the script, and I went back to them, I'm like, guys, this is the craziest fucking script I've ever read in my life.
Is that the name of the script, or like, is that... Yeah. Okay.
It was. Yeah, it is the name of the script. So, and they're like, well, you're going to talk to the showrunner tomorrow. We're organizing a call and you're going to talk to them tomorrow. So I'm like, what? Okay. So I put together a pitch deck, all this stuff. They're like, they want to know, you know, what this is going to take.
Okay.
So I get on the call. So just to frame it for you, it is we did a pilot. The pilot got picked up. And we started the series, and then it got canceled, right? So, but at that point, what became known to me was that it was a half-hour comedy involving CG VFX talking bears photoreal talking bears, voiced by Will Ferrell, Sarah Silverman, you know, among others, sure. right? So, and that talent was already like, they were signed. They were like, you know, basically good sure. to go. So, and then Damon Wayans Jr. was the like live action component, and they were going to interact. There's a whole like vengeance story. It was absolutely nuts. The bears have sex. They do.
This seems like someone saw Cocaine things. Bear and they say, how did we turn this into a series?
So this was before okay. Cocaine Bear. Cocaine, and we wound up shopping kind of at the okay. same time. And like D-Neg was bidding on Cocaine Bear and Kill the Orange okay. Face Bear. I can tell you, Cocaine Bear's got nothing on Kill the Orange Face
oh,
Bear.
Oh, I'm sure. Like, right. Yeah.
Nothing.
Cocaine Bear's pretty low budget.
It was. Well, no, not even that, but just like from a subject oh, sure. matter yeah, standpoint. Right. Yeah. Like the things that we were going to do were just absolutely nuts, and what we were setting up was absolutely insane. So D-Neg wound up working on okay. the pilot, and that got picked up, and all of this was through like the SWAT guys. They just like put me mm-hmm. in this room. They're like, Chad, meet these guys, and I'm like okay sure. And that, you know, started, and they've always been great. They're like, yeah, you know, go do that, you have fun, and I can kind of manage both things, and you know, they allow me to do that, which awesome. Is great.
So what, I mean, what is it like? I mean, when you're working on a studio side, do they keep you at the studio and they just throw you new projects that they're working on, and they try to get you sort of look at the bigger picture?
Paul and Jim will like to do that, you know, because they've got a lot of stuff coming uh-huh. through. A lot of times I generally try to just like fly below the radar and just do like whatever it is that I'm doing and just stay focused right. on that. I have people that I like to work sure. with, and those are that's always been more important to me, is like the relationships and the right. people as opposed to the project. Yep. And like SWAT's a really great one. The Sympathizer, right, which I'm just coming yep. off of, that was another one which like the team there was amazing. Mm-hmm. And like Ron and Karen, the UPM and line producer, they were awesome. Janet Muswell was awesome mm-hmm. to work with. So like that group is another group where I'm like, yeah, I want to work with those people because they're just pleasant and nice, and obviously, you know, have a high bar expectation, which is also, you know, where I enjoy sure. being.
Sure. Well, that's awesome. Okay. Well, that sounds like you found a pretty good place for yourself after all this. Yeah.
Hopefully. Yeah. I mean, that's,
is that what you, I mean, when you go back, let's go back to you, like talking to Lyndon and doing Arctic, did you ever imagine you being here or?
No. I mean, that's one of the things, like I was talking with somebody recently and they, you know, they were asking me about like my trajectory or whatever. And like, I had no idea what a VFX supervisor sure. was, you know, when I started this, like there was never a like, I want to be that, right?
Yeah. Like, I mean, is it just no. because you were doing architecture that Lynn was like, oh, you got to try this CG stuff? Is that really what got you into it, or?
I mean, I started doing the CG stuff like while doing architecture because sure. I had seen what he had done, right? And like the cars and some of the other stuff he was doing. I was like, well, I could do that. So I started messing with it. And he, I mean, you know, architecture school is absolutely grueling. Yes. And music school is also absolutely grueling. Mm-hmm. So Lyndon was basically like, you know, Chad can do that. He can do sure. this. And so they put me in a room and was like, go. Right, right, right. I was like, all right, yeah. sure. And there was definitely like a learning curve right. for sure, especially on like the automotive stuff. That was my first month or two was like, yeah. okay. But I mean, you know, it just becomes like second nature and you're placing the lights and doing sure. all the stuff and it pretty quickly.
So what, I mean, obviously, you know, episodic is his, you know, you were coming into it in 2013, 2014, stuff like that. And so it has changed drastically over the years, the expectations, mm-hmm. what's made out of it, you know,
yeah.
it used to be, you know, CG was like, questionable in every shot. And now it's like, has to be at least and on par with some of the best. So how has that transition been of like expecting quality over the years?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because even on a show, like we can look at it in the context of like when we were at Fuse, mm-hmm. when I started there, streaming was just really like getting its legs, right? And like some of the big spectacles, and obviously House of Dragons was out already, but they were Game of Thrones. I have House of Dragons in my head because I watched it last night. Game of Thrones was really getting its legs on like full.
And they're like, oh my God, people are doing like full feature stuff on a TV show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there was still like working on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., there was a high bar. You know, Mark Kolpak really has a high expectation. And anything Marvel at that point, there was a really high bar. So that was where we started to see the like week by week, really trying to like notch it up again and again and again, but doing it on a network level versus trying to compete against the streamers was definitely difficult and is always difficult. But I think that now like we have the tool sets that are just even amplifying, making that difference even less. So, right. Like I'm seeing my teams that are, we're working on the Sympathizer where we had months to work on an explosion, do an equivalent explosion on SWAT in a couple of weeks at the same quality level.
Sure.
Right. Like it's actually really impressive what these guys are starting to pull off. And like Ingenuity is who I go to for all of my like fire and everything.
Big Houdini place.
It's impressive. Big Houdini place. Yep. But like, you know, Grant's great because he's there. Like
I know Grant Miller. He's been on the podcast.
Okay, you know Grant. Yeah. Oh yeah, that's right. So Grant's great because, and one of the things I think he and I really get along about is that he's not like agnostic in any one thing as far as software or anything. Like he's not the guy that like digs his heels in and this is the way we do it and we're going to do it this way. If something looks better, Grant will change and spin their pipeline around like 360, 180, you know, whatever it takes in a heartbeat to like make sure that they're innovating. And I think that's one of the things that I've really always appreciated about him, and I've always appreciated about their studio.
Yeah. What about your transition, you know, into things during the pandemic? Obviously, there was a lot of stuff going on there. The demand for episodic was way higher, right? And then suddenly everyone wants virtual production. Like what? How did you sort of manage all of those expectations?
I mean, it was... So the whole COVID thing was really weird. We wound up, SWAT was one of the last shows shooting during when like everybody went down, right? So we actually wound up doing an air-to-air unit, and I was in a little plane and we had a helicopter. And like, that's one of the fun things about this show is we have all the toys, like feature level, all the toys, helicopters, planes, you know, you name it, like the best driving rigs, all this stuff. So we were the last show to shoot. And then I think one of the first shows to pick back up. So during like the whole COVID thing, we were only down for like a month and a half. Right. And then we were right back up. Right. Especially because we were finishing stuff up in post. I think the most stressful thing about that time was like, you didn't know if studios were going to last and how they were transitioning and if they were going remote and all these things, right? So that occurred, and then that's about when Kill the Orange Face Bear also wound up in my lap. So I wound up working on that project for about 2.5 years, and that was, there wasn't a lot of asks about some of these things that were transitioning. Crowds, obviously, we were doing a ton of that because of COVID and everything. But virtual production really, I wound up on a show called Dollface. And Disney was really trying to push their setup at that point. There was an agenda to try to get people to do virtual production. Still really early days. And
was Disney in terms of the ILM Mandalorian stuff that was going on? Is that what you're...
Yes, but they were trying to build their own stage, and they were setting up, they had like a relationship with... who was it? The guys out of Sun Valley. Oh my God, why can't I forget?
Was it Lux?
Their name.
Not Lux. Okay.
Oh, I'll remember it the second this podcast ends. So they were kind of pushing it and really wanted us to use it, but I was pushing very anti-no on it.
What was your reason for not wanting it? What was your concern?
I think there was and there still is a serious lack of understanding about like what you can do and can't do. And because of that, a lot of wasted time and money. It's very expensive. Obviously, we all know that to go in and do it. And if you're not prepped properly and you your DP and you aren't in alignment on what needs to happen and what can happen, that there are serious cost implications to that that unfortunately cannot be undone.
That's okay. Good that you brought that up. I mean, during the pandemic, there was this, oh, this is going to save our ass, right? And they didn't know why. Right. They're like, oh, we don't have to travel. So therefore we can shoot in a stage and that's how it's going to be. And I remember actually Lou Pecora was telling me at one point, I think he was in Zoic and he was like, people were like, let's just Mandalorian it. And I'm like,
yes, let's just Mandalorian it.
I'm like, what does that mean? You know, and it's like, we'll just use the power of nanotechnology. Like what?
Well, and I mean, you know, people not understanding, like, because at that point, nobody was really doing like the two camera setups where you're oscillating, you know, your shutter speed and all that stuff. So, you know, I remember we had somebody show up and like they brought a second camera body and we were supposed to be doing a projected Unreal scene. And like, no, you can't shoot that. And like really trying to explain like, no, this isn't going to work. You can't bring that. You can't fly in a second camera body while we're projecting. Like, look at what you're going to capture. Like, this is useless. But there was a serious like lack of understanding and lack of knowledge about all these things. And even like getting the camera too close or too, you know, all of these things. So we had issues with that. And I know even like, there's another really big show that was shooting on the volume and like recently that was having massive issues with all the same stuff, like not understanding how to get two bodies working, like all these different things. And it's still, even on that show, very debatable whether or not it actually saved them any money and they actually think it cost them a whole lot more money than, you know, than it was really worth. So, I mean, I think that there's a lot of opportunity for it. And I know like, you know, Nadell was actually over at Torchlight recently talking with Alex Cannon and Alex Locasil. This is my plug for those guys. Alex, you owe me. no, get a 50% discount next time you go to Torchlight. You know, but they're setting up some cool stuff and it's all very like visionary and, you know, like a sandbox, you know, basically. And I think that obviously there's a lot to be said for it and virtual production and everything in that capacity, like in a sandbox and just like exploring different ideas. But I'm still very reluctant. Like,
well, I got to tell you about,
what
we're doing with Project Arena. I don't know if you know about Project Arena or not.
No, I don't. Okay.
Yeah. It's a long story, but I'm not going to bore people in the podcast. But I will explain it to you and I'm curious to see your thoughts are on that. Because I think that you're right. I think there's a lot of expectations and stuff, but they're stuck in this. The problem is you're stuck in this process and this loop and a pipeline that is not necessarily a VFX friendly pipeline or even a production friendly pipeline, you know, so.
Correct. Well, or a pipeline that is thinking about VFX in that capacity, right? Like they're used to production designer is the first person you bring on, right? And casting, and it, as opposed to what's changing and we're seeing it change is production design and VFX are some of the first people that are being brought on, especially for these big shows where we're actually having to plan. And there is the potential of, you might want to do shoot on a volume and we might need to get assets ready. But if you aren't starting it from that runway, then you, right out of the gate, you're already, it's not going to happen.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. So yeah, I was curious about where you are on that, because obviously from the studio side of things, I think that there's a level of, there's a reality, right? People are sometimes going, you know, what's going on? And then it's the reality of it. Well, what about what?
They want to do it a lot. There's a lot of talk that, you know, it's always, what if we did this?
Sure.
And they don't like hearing.
Yeah. When you, well, I think, you know, it's my, I don't know, but and this is coming from someone that makes technology and wants, you know, my company sells technology, right? But at the same time, at the same time, I feel like if it's not servicing the production, it doesn't make any sense, right? If you put technology ahead of what you're actually trying to accomplish, that's not the right attitude. Because virtual production is actually a not new technology. I mean, this is essentially rear projection, but freaking Hitchcock was using it, right? And so the only thing that's changing is that you can move your camera around a little bit better and you can do a lot of things.
Right.
And that does open the door to a lot of interesting ideas, and it does enable a lot of stuff in terms of what your environments are. And it makes rear projection a much more viable solution. But at the same time, if you think you're just going to do everything in camera, it's not true.
No. It's all a myth. I mean, it's unfortunate too, because it's very similar to there. No VFX was used or no CGI was used in the filming of this movie. And we did everything on the volume. Those two things are like, I think, the two biggest lies that exist that it, like, encompass VFX.
Why do you think that's the new, like, especially now? I mean, we've had several episodes where we've had people talk about this, like how CG has been villainized by Hollywood, especially anyone that's in the marketing side of things, right? So why do you like, how do you manage that?
I mean, it's difficult. You know, you've got a lot of people that look it. You can't really point a finger at any one person or any one studio and say like it's their fault necessarily. You know, but I think that there's a technological reach that Marvel is always making, which is good, and it has benefits in R&D and all the studios that, you know, all of us use to do photoreal VFX in de-aging and face replacements and all these fun, you know, crazy things. But in that reach becomes a lack of reality, unfortunately. And that lack of reality, then I think all these directors are looking at Marvel and it's like, oh, it's not real, and it's all of these terrible things, right? Whatever they want to say about it. Plenty of directors have said lots of mean things about Marvel. But that reach is needed in order for all of us to benefit from that the technological leaps that are happening there that help to make some of the other more standard VFX more real and whatnot. So I just personally think that, that's unfortunately a Marvel vilification.
Well, I think that,
and like,
yes and no, right? Because yes, Marvel is being villainized in some ways, but then they're like, oh, the reason Marvel stuff sucks is not because Marvel stories suck, it's because VFX, which is the wrong...
Right, which is the wrong way to look at it.
Your scripts probably need some ideas.
I wasn't going to say that.
And that's, ironically, that's the cheapest thing to fix. You start with a good script and you can do a lot better work.
good story is amazing. It really goes a long way.
And you can forgive a lot of really bad VFX if you have a really great script.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, that's like, there's so many great movies from the 80s and 90s that have not good VFX.
Terminator?
And they were really, Well,
I love Terminator, and Stan Winston was doing great work. But if you look at the Stan Winston stuff and him tearing his face apart, I was like, ooh, really?
Well, even like Nightmare on Elm Street.
But those are great, right? And those are fun, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But, you know, why is it that suddenly those are great because they're quote unquote practical, but they don't really.
Right.
I mean, if you're going to compare, they look great because they have that feeling of that works with the thing that you're looking at. Right. It's the same thing with Poor Things, right? Poor Things is like very bizarre visual effects, not necessarily the greatest thing, but the whole thing works, right? Because they've got a story that sort of makes it all work.
Yeah. That supports it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a visual consistency of language. I think that's the other thing that, like, unfortunately, when you parse out to 36 different studios, all these different things, it's hard to maintain consistency across your, you know, visual language.
I mean, that's part of your job, though, right?
Oh, yeah, totally. That's my job. But I can't imagine, you know, that's one of the reasons why we break things up in the way that, you know, makes sure. sense for us and we can maintain visual continuity.
Is that your hardest job, but is to try to find that?
That is one of the things is casting it. Yeah, I think like making the pick of who you really think can do this and who's going to be the best person for it. Because, you know, I mean, obviously, like certain people are really great. Certain studios are really great at certain things. And it's always the balancing of the money mm-hmm. and the quality and that like ever changing. Do you hit it with a hammer and try to go with ILM or, you know, you use somebody a little bit more nimble and potentially that can also punch above their weight belt or, you know, their weight.
And you don't always get, I mean, I'm not bashing ILM, but I'm just saying sometimes you go to the expensive place and you don't always get what you think you're going to get. Right. You're like, oh, we spent a lot of money on this and I could have done it with these guys I know in Argentina and they're going to, you know, so or whatever it is. Right.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately,
it's a risk reward thing, right?
It's a risk reward thing. And it's also, you know, obviously like your priorities and their priorities need to be in mm-hmm. alignment. And if you're coming with the right director and you're coming with the right mm-hmm. show and studio, you probably have an alignment. If you're not, then it is hard for you to be like the priority at a place like that and to know that you're going to be a priority, at least not the sure. priority. Of course, whereas you can go to, yes, somewhere in Poland or Argentina or, you know, some of these other places in the world that have some great, great talent.
Definitely. Poland is a good one. That's a great example. There's some really amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Poland is one of my favorites.
Yeah, they've got some amazing visual effects artists. They're very under the radar. So mm-hmm. Definitely some bargains.
Yes. They are one of those, like, I think they punch way above their their weight and, like, quality for money, like. Yeah, definitely above bar.
The biggest problem I always have when I'm working with places like that is actually time zone feedback problems.
Yeah. I mean, you get used to it. It's where
when it gets closer to the deadline, it's harder.
Yeah, it's tough when it's close to the deadline. I guess I've been doing it for a long time. Like, I've got a long-standing relationship with Yonex, mm-hmm. and they've been on every show of mine. Like, we pre-track everything sure. on our shows. And because of that, we're always like on this split time zone. Like, it's just kind of, obviously I've got a shorthand with them. Whereas somebody like Platige, mm-hmm. yes, as you get up closer to delivering and stuff, it gets a little bit more stressful on our side, sure. especially when you've got your vendors here in the States and then your vendors elsewhere. Yep. But I think generally they're great at accommodating, and working in our time zones when they need
how you know, obviously we've had a bunch of strikes recently and a lot of turmoil in Hollywood. How is it that on the studio side, how have they responded? Because a lot of the questions about this is how technology is going to change filmmaking, right? Specifically AI tools. Are they looking at places like talking to people like you and like, how is this going to, what is it, Matt? Should we use this or not use it? Like, how do you manage that?
Yeah. There are a lot of people out there pushing AI tools in different capacities. Sure. And a lot of the VFX executives are looking at it and asking us to look and vet, you know, these studios and try them out, see, you know, whether or not it's just BS or not, which, you know, a lot of it is, I think, like, that's,
yeah, how that's did, is that, what, is that your thing? Is like real, not real? Like, is that, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it really is like, even just when you're vetting the studio, like I'll get sent pages and like this studio or that sure. studio. And they're like, you know, look at these people. Would you use them? They want to like offer their services or whatever. And there's a lot of like, yeah, right. no, yeah, no.
Right. And is it mainly because you know that what they're promising they can't deliver, or is it because you don't trust what they're doing?
I think there's a twofold. So obviously from the studios, your data, where your data is from is super important, right? And that's the most, number one, copyright, right? So we're definitely looking at that.
How do you vet that?
That's a really tough thing to vet. And if you're not saying where your data is coming from right out of the gate, to me, you're a no.
Right.
Like it's, and that is one of those things, like you should be able to say, this is where our data comes from. This is, well, yeah, if it's the internet, that's bad. Because that is, I can tell you, like, I've been talking with one of the studios, and there's a real fear that, like, any use of AI is somehow going to be this, like, thing that's going to take over and Terminator at the studio, and they've got all copyright issues and all these things, and it's generatively creating things that it's not supposed to, right? Which, obviously, we know that that's not going the way it's going to happen, or what is happening and how people are using these tools. You know, machine learning and AI, there's a distinct and generative AI, right? I think that's the other thing, is like, there's a real lack of understanding between like different AI and machine learning and what the different models can do and all the, you know, so on and so forth. So there's definitely fear at the studios of like VFX studios using AI. I think they want, they're watching to see if there's like investments or opportunities in tools for real, like not just these made up things like we're gonna fix everything, you know, miraculously and generate your VFX amazingly. But they're watching. I think it's like cautious observance and cautious optimism as opposed to like them just jumping in full in.
Do you see, I mean, we've heard rumors, and you don't have to answer this, of places like, oh no, they're just hiring entire departments of prompt engineers that are just writing concept, making all the concept art in AI, and it's just completely bypassing all of the way that they traditionally do things with concept artists, et cetera. Do you feel that's true, or is that mostly just a paranoia thing that's happening?
I know, like, firsthand, that a number of the studios ban their concept artists from using any generative AI. Like the big ones. I'm not going to name the names, but the big ones. I have close friends, I can tell you firsthand, they are not allowed to use any AI. They're not allowed to play with it. They're not allowed to experiment with it at home, like have it on their machines, any of it.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes sense, because I understand that there's a concept of... At the same time, when I was in studios, before any of this was happening, and people were coming up with ideas of films, they were pulling up all kinds of images off the internet and posting up on their wall, which... Even more directly using it.
I think that a lot of what we use AI for in something like Midjourney, and when I say we, like even myself, right? It's like the Google image search now. Instead of Googling something, I prompt it and flash through variations and all these things. And in that way, look, I mean, we've used Midjourney to prompt and show some visuals to a director. And then take that and give it to the concept painter. Okay, this was the thing that they liked. Go and now actually make it cool. Right? And good. And
like, which isn't different from they like the idea of this thing from Maleficent. Yes. So do something along the lines of
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Yes, we could show them a picture from Maleficent or whatever it is. And it's the same thing, but in this way, you're guiding it in like tone, color, like all these things, which... You can actually put in the subject matter. And,
but the
you know,
concept artists,
I mean,
themselves, they need to create something original without any of those things.
Yes. Yeah. And we're still, so we're not foregoing the step of
exploration
of going to concept artists. But what we are expediting is the talk between me and the director and then what the concept artist gets, as opposed to, well, it might be this or it might be that or it might be this or that. And instead of spending X with a concept artist, I'm maybe spending half X. I don't know. We're not going into it though. It's not like I'm going to save.
No,
money
you're just
doing
saving
this.
Yourself iteration and headache. I know. Yeah.
Exactly.
I actually, you know, there is obviously a lot of questions about the copyright, which I believe is a really very, very valid question. I just don't feel that it's a question that should be solved by public opinion. I think it should be solved by courts.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. What's interesting too is somebody, you know, I mess with AI and whatnot, and I'm a photographer sure. as well. So a friend of mine, I had posted something, and he was like, "Dude, like he's been building kind of like a mining, finding all the images and things like that that are being used by Midjourney and these people to train, you know, their engines." And he found that some of my photography was used in this. And he's like, "You know, do you know this?" I'm like, "I mean, no, but," and I prompted it to try to recreate a photo that I've taken. And it actually, it was disturbingly very mm-hmm. close. It's like, that's mm-hmm. interesting. So, I mean, all of it is definitely questionable, even somebody like me that my shit's been stolen sure. to train this. But it doesn't negate the value that we have for it as far as using it as a right. tool. But yes, I agree. It needs to be legally worked out with courts, not...
Well, I'm curious. That's actually really cool because I've actually asked a lot of people about different things. And it's really nice to hear that perspective because I think people need to realize like where the studios are on this. And I think you're right. I mean, I've actually heard, you know, as technology companies are developing AI tools, there's a lot of studios that say thanks, but no thanks, because we just don't want to mm-hmm. deal with the the legal ramifications, be it down the road, and we just don't want to risk it, right? And, you know, I actually... I've heard of certain studios that have stopped updating all of their Adobe products because they cannot mm-hmm. risk the copyright issues.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a huge problem, and it is something like even I think we're starting to see it in like actor contracts, yep. things like that as well, as far as them trying to push no AI used in anything on the show. Or I think that's a little.
It's hard to judge yes. that, you know.
Exactly.
And I always kind of jokingly say, like, you know, when people say ethically sourced AI, I was like, that's like cage-free eggs. What the hell does that mean? You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
I mean, we have some ideas, and I'm sure you have sure. ideas as far as like what is ethically sourced right. AI, and how to actually train, you know, for this. But it's a whole other. I think the one good thing about ethically sourced AI is it gives VFX a job.
Oh yeah,
at least as I see it. Yeah,
I know of. There's a lot of AI training that's being done. Let's say, I don't know, in augmented reality, right? Because they need to, augmented reality mm-hmm. needs to recognize things in a real world and be able to put those together. And what's interesting about that is that it was cheaper for companies to train it on synthetic data than on real data. So VFX mm-hmm. was creating tons of images for training purposes, yep. right? They're not reality. Yep. They're just tons of things that represent reality.
Correct.
So they can get through it quicker, right? You need to recognize everything yep. that's in a living room. You create millions of different iterations of a living room. It's much cheaper in CG than it is to build correct. A million living rooms.
Well, especially with photography yep. that you own and all of yep. these other things. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I think that there is definitely an opportunity sure. for CG and VFX, at least how long lasting that is. I don't know. Like how quickly can you train everything? Like obviously that yeah. takes a while, but certainly people are looking yeah. at that.
Interesting. Well, that was a good little divert. Tell us a little bit about what you're up to now and like what's going on. What can we look forward to seeing?
Right now I'm
okay.
taking a break.
Good for you.
I was on the Sympathizer for the last like oh, wow. 2 years. And so that was a sure. fun show, but definitely like difficult yeah. finishing it out. So now I'm sitting and waiting. I have a project that I'm hopeful nice. For, but we'll see. It's still in the early
awesome.
Days.
Are you seeing the industry starting to pick up again in terms of, you know, post strike and stuff?
A little. I think,
it's going to be a different industry, I think a little. Don't There's, you think? We're yeah. new Hollywood, right?
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, I mean, I think there's obviously going to, you know, things are going to pick up, but it does seem somebody posted on LinkedIn, yesterday or mm-hmm. 2 days ago, something like that. Although I'm very behind on LinkedIn, so it could have been a month ago for all I know. But it was like credits of a, of the last Marvel movie, mm-hmm. right? And they were saying, like, you know, the year previously, there were two or three Marvel movies right. published, right? But this year, there's only right. one, right? And just even that downturn in one studio's production obviously has a huge implication. And what they have on their coming up is much less than what, you know, was there previously.
But that's just so Marvel. There's other things that are happening.
Then that's right? just Marvel. And everybody else also is like,
yeah, but I'm starting back, to see more right? interesting projects, right? Like you do,
correct.
And no, you're not going to have the 1,000 VFX artist shows anymore.
Yeah.
But you do have interesting yep. films like Civil War that are coming out. You do have things, you know.
Yeah.
So I think there's just a different change that's going to happen that I think is going to be different. Yep. So, and adapting to that yeah, world is going to be interesting.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that's exactly where it, and so I think like the MPCs and ILMs of the world that are built around these like mega movies and stuff, like obviously that's they're going to be affected mm-hmm. by that, and like we'll have to mm-hmm. adapt, and they always do. Yeah. Right?
They've done it's this not, for 30 like, years. They've seen lots mm-hmm. of changes.
yeah. Yes.
40 years.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, they'll adapt and everybody else is going to be adapting exactly. along with them. But yeah, it's, I think it is turning up though. Like I'm seeing other friends get jobs and people start yeah. To come. The unfortunate part though is like, you know, friends of mine who are starting projects right now, we won't turn over plates to vendors till next right. year. Right. So like I might like my next project, I think will start in like mm-hmm. August. I won't turn over till September of next year, probably after filming and wow. editorial and all of that. So like, that's huge, you know, that's like every, yeah, it's the whole year is just gone. Right.
Even yeah. But we also had a lot of stuff, talks. Right? Like it was ridiculous. Mm-hmm. At one point, I think in 2022 or 23, whatever, Netflix was releasing a new movie every week. That was yeah. a little crazy.
Yeah.
For one studio.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. Yeah. It's definitely excessive yeah,
for sure.
Or what I would look at and think is excessive, but I get what do
yeah,
I know?
I don't know. I mean it depends on if people are watching it or not, and people were watching it. I think that the interests in films have definitely grown. I just think that people are also mm-hmm. a little bit, you know, they do have a little bit of a Marvel fatigue, and that's not to say that Marvel films are bad. Yeah. It's just too many of them.
yeah well, but I think it has left a place for studios like A24,
oh, yeah.
you know, to interject yeah. or inject
we
themselves.
We saw this in
so
the 1960s, and then, you know, mm-hmm.
yep.
this is what's happening again, which is great. You know, they just thought, oh, we're going to make the Western musicals and, you know, and Doris Day musicals forever. And turns out people weren't tired of it. Finally, mm-hmm. you know, so we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah.
Well, awesome, Chad. Thank you so much. This has been really insightful. Oh my God, so great to catch up on all these our old yeah. acquaintances. It's funny. Like now that I'm talking, I feel like we've talked forever, and this is the first time we've actually met, which is hilarious.
yeah.
So cool. Thanks so much for doing this, and that we're looking forward to hearing all the cool projects you're up to.
Yeah. Hopefully, I will be able to share what's next soon.
All right, and then we'll have you back.
That's right. Yeah.